Calling all benders and non-benders alike. Jump into the epic world of Avatar with your favorite podcast, Avatar Braving the Elements. Hosted by me, Janet Varney.
And me, Dante Bosco. Each week we'll recap and discuss a new episode.
So come join us and our amazing guests, from creators to cast to superfans, to chat about all things Avatarverse.
It's Fire Nation time. Book of Fire. Let's go. Listen to Avatar Braving the Elements
wherever you get your podcasts.
The Last Kids on Earth and their superhero alter egos are back in the latest installment of the graphic novel spinoff series, The Last Comics on Earth, Too Many Villains. Jack, June, Quint, and Dirk face their biggest challenge yet, creating the sequel to their hit graphic novel in a mad dash, puzzle-filled race across Apocalyptia to stop the biggest evil plan in history. Hey, you know what the creators of Last Comics on Earth's evil plan is? Make me and my kids love these books. Seriously, my younger kid is a huge fan of both the Last Kids series and the Last Comic series.
It's true.
And now I'm hooked too. The whole team has created a delightful cast of characters with some fantastic kid-friendly art throughout that will appeal to readers of all ages. Buy your copy of The Last Comics on Earth in stores today. You can also visit lastkidsonearth.com to learn more. What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we're coming to you live from a couple of different places. We are live over on Crowdcast. We're live over on YouTube. Or maybe you're listening to this as a podcast. If with so, cool. But that's happening.
Very
later.
Cool.
Very cool.
Can't forget your roots, Alex. And we're audio at our roots. And it shows in how beautiful our faces are.
Oh, my gosh. I have this beautiful, very clear camera going on, with the horrible stark white background going on behind me. Now, guys, we have a very exciting show for you. We have some great guests here that we're going to bring in a little bit. They are the creative team behind Lock and Key, Hell and Gone. But first, we got a couple of orders of business we got to talk about.
Let's
get to the list, man. Come on.
You got to do the list?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is everybody's favorite section. And actually, it kind of is my favorite section because it's where we pay tribute to the many people that support us at patreon.com/comicbookclub. There's a level where once a month we read off everybody's name. This is that time of the month when we read off the names. And yes, we nail it every time out of the gate.
Don't set us up, you asshole.
A lot of people actually just listen to this portion of the podcast and they're like, I'm sort of here for the names. I don't like comics.
Oh, yes, man.
So again, if you are tuning in for the first time, we're going to get to the content of the interview in a second. But first, here's the Patreon names, kicking it off with Aaron C. Hollis.
Adam Marks.
Adriel Moreland.
Elena Fontenot.
Amanda Harris.
Amy Gonzalez.
Andrew Edge.
Andrew Primo.
Andrew Tillman.
Benjamin Brown.
Carly W.
Chris Terlizzi.
Clemens Luer.
Corby Dorby Doodle.
Curtis LaRock.
Demand Ryan.
Dan Snow.
Dancer Danny Cabral.
Daniel Fuentes.
Daniel Warden.
Danny Heck.
Danny Ollie.
Debbie Gloom.
Dennis Scott.
Dylan LJ.
Eduardo Martinez.
Aaron Dorian.
Jeffrey Reicher.
Gerard de Villiers.
Greg Mocha.
Isaac Carter.
James Connolly.
James Kurtz.
Jason Donahue.
Joe Lean.
John George.
Jonathan Jong.
Joshua Gibson.
Joshua W. Broxson.
Catherine Adamson.
KC Newhaven.
Kevin Grimes.
Kevin Kleinrock.
Kieran Broderick.
Cody Thomas.
Kyle.
Lee Brown.
Liwana Thomas.
Lucas Sink.
Mark Zeller.
Matt Tice.
Megan Thigpen.
Michael A. Sargent.
Mike D'Argenio.
Mitchell McDonald.
Nelson Martinez.
Nick Broughton.
Nick Grayson.
Off-White Savior.
What? Official CBC Chef, Brett Macris.
Oh. Omnia Solart.
Orin Dix.
Pedro A. Rangel.
Primetime Pauly G.
Rev Mikey.
Salute your shorts.
Sarah Schottmuller.
Sarah Schaefer.
Scott Carpenter.
Scott England.
Stanley.
Tamila Rush.
The Big Flood.
The 12 Batch.
Victor Perez.
Will Buchanan.
W.M. Leitch.
Zika's viral comics. Look at us crushing it.
There we go. Thank you, everybody who has supported our show. Again, if you would like to support our show, and we really do appreciate it, patreon.com/comicbookclub. You are super awesome. Tell you what, I hope we never become successful because that list is going to get crazy.
Oh, man. Thank you for supporting. Sorry if we suck at names.
We have a great job in our futures announcing like a minor league baseball team because I think we're crushed that.
Oh, man.
Now, there is one other thing that we should probably mention here at the top, and then we will get to the interview. And just to mention, for the interview portion, we'll be chatting.
So excited for
the
interview.
But also, definitely drop your questions either to ask a question here on Crowdcast or in the comments over on YouTube. I'm going to keep an eye on them because we'd love to get your questions.
Let's get some questions.
This epic crossover as well. But this is a little bit of news for our end that we're pretty excited about. Our podcast is going to be joining the Fansided Network.
Yes.
Now, what that means is there's a website, a series of websites owned by a place called Fansided. We are joining their podcast network. They're going to be rolling it out in a couple of different ways. What that means for you listening is nothing.
Why even bring it up?
Let it ride.
Yeah, you're still going to get the podcast same as usual, or at least you should. If you have any problems, if there's any hiccups in the crossover, definitely
hit Alex up on Twitter.
But they've been pretty awesome. We're excited to work with them. Yeah. And it should be pretty cool.
Any IT problems, hit up Pete on Twitter. He's sort of our major domo when it comes to dealing with translations to our transcripts.
Have
obviously,
you tried throwing your phone out the window?
Yes. Pete, using his former Genius Bar experience to bring it to the great podcast universe.
I used to work in the fruit stand.
That's right. The what?
Great.
The fruit stand.
I've lost track of what we're doing. Before we bring the guys in here, I wanted to give a shout out to a couple of people on YouTube who are watching. Thanesis LeBru, if I messed that up. Good morning from Greece.
Wow. Yes. That's
awesome.
All right.
Also, Adrian Streether is in Hull, UK. So we got people all over the world watching, which is super cool. So let's not keep them waiting because they are up late at night or in the morning or whatever's going on. I'm going to bring the team here into our stream. Oh, there we go.
Hey!
There we go. So first off, we got writer Joe Hill. Also coming in is editor Chris Ryle, picking his nose with the hell key to hell.
Picking his nose with the key to hell.
Yes.
Oh.
I think it makes a lot of sense.
Oh, man.
There we go. And slowly making his way in here is artist Gabriel Rodriguez. He should be in any second. But guys, welcome. This is awesome. This is so exciting. I actually want to turn it over to Justin first, because we're all big Lock and Key fans, but he's the big Sandman fan. So go for it, Justin. What do you have to say about
it? Honestly, it's so exciting to get a love letter from, this book is clearly for me. So thank you for doing that. Just like to be able to have a targeted, focused book in there is really exciting.
I think when we sat down to first discuss the idea of actually executing the comic, the first thing we said is, what would Justin like? How could we make him happy?
Yeah.
You know,
I noticed the subtle,
okay.
There's a line in there that you say just in time, and I get it. Like, I know what you're saying. You're communicating with me. We have an exchange.
There's Gabriel Rodriguez. Well, look at this. We got our own Brady Bunch thing going on, right?
It's
now.
Very cool.
Well, the thing is that I was joining this just for the list of names at the beginning, so I
I'm sorry, we didn't read your name right.
Oh, man. That's
I think
great.
It's important for the viewers at home to know just how completely unbiased you guys are when it comes to Lock and Key.
Classic character.
The reveals. You're compromising our high journalistic standard. Yeah.
I got.
Well, guys, I know you've talked about this a lot, but this is a big event, obviously, for comics. But this is also something that is very tied into both the Lock and Key universes and the Sandman universes. I know you've been talking about it for a while, but when did the discussions become serious? When did it actually start seeming like it might become a reality?
I don't think we ever had a serious discussion, but things didn't happen again. But it's right?
I know when we first discussed the possibility of doing a Sandman crossover, but it was years before we ever imagined it might actually happen. The Lock and Key show wound up on Netflix and is really in its best possible incarnation. We're so proud of it.
Great.
You know, so great cast, and Carlton Cuse and Meredith Averill, who or the showrunners have been absolutely killing it, you know. And but it was a while getting Lock and Key to TV, and there were two other pilots filmed for a possible Lock and Key show, and the very first of them was filmed in Pittsburgh, and I want to say about 2013, by Mark Romanek with a great script from Josh Friedman, one of the reasons it never got on the air that Fox passed on it was Mark Romanek was only able to film about 70% of Josh's really wonderful script because they filmed in Pittsburgh in the middle of the winter. And there was a colossal snowstorm that shut down filming for most of a week. And so they had to scramble and make up time, and a whole bunch of the script wound up not getting filmed.
Wow.
Because we were snowed in, we wound up staying in a hotel in Pitt. We had all convened to visit the set right as the snowstorm was hitting. And so instead of visiting the set, we wound up staying in the hotel, mostly hanging out in this very cozy saloon, a lot of leather and brass, very 19th century,
I love that this is like a horror, you're setting up a horror story about how you made it.
I'm pretty sure the bartender was that guy from Kubrick's The Shining, you know, with the slick back hair. We mostly sat around and swapped pitches, ideas for Lock and Key stories, you know, and I remember it was a very productive time. And I remember clearly that Gabe cracked a joke that solved the ending of the first series. Even though we were still years away from writing it, the solution to sort of some puzzles that we set up that arrived in Alpha and Omega began as, you know, Gabe sort of maybe cracking a joke or maybe pretending a serious idea was a joke. I don't know.
He's tricky.
That guy is tricky. Right. You gotta keep your eye on him.
He also, though, we had done an issue called Open the Moon, which a dying member of the Locke family is hand-delivered to a kind of heaven. And Gabe said, we've been to heaven. When are we going to go to hell?
Of course, say that.
I was like, I don't know when we'll be able to get on the Comic Book Live podcast. But, you know, we can hope for the near future. No,
everything comes to full circle.
Yeah, that's right. Wishes, dreams really do come true. But you know, I don't remember who said it. I know that I said if we were going to do hell, I'd want to go to the hell from Sandman. Wouldn't that be great? Someone, maybe it was Chris, said, well, there is that key to the gates of hell that was a crucial plot element of Season of Mists. So that's where the idea began. In terms of when we wound up getting permission to do it, I'm not sure. I mean,
Hasn't come in yet.
We still don't have it. No. I mean, I know that I was talking to that, to Neil Gaiman about the possibility as far back as 2015, but you know,
yeah, I mean, as far as the way we all mark time, we basically mark time by the different Lock and Key pilots. So it did,
yeah, us too.
Pilots ago, and we got approval probably just like a pilot and a half ago, because it was the kind of thing that you muse about. And you go, it'd be fun to play with this key and bring this key into the key house world, but you go, that's never going to happen. Sandman's done and finished, like. That's the sort of sacred text, you know, that we're not going to get to play with that. And so it was never taken all that seriously until, I think, yeah, Joe, you talked to Neil. And once Neil said, I like it, that makes every conversation with DC that much easier.
A little bit easier, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a way, we started developing this idea, considering that given the time, if we arrived to the point in which we wanted to tell this tale about Chamberlain Locks and his kids regarding the story with Hell, we could eventually tell the story in our own version of Hell. We could have used our version of Lucifer and etc. But it was exciting from the beginning just to play with the idea of doing it with that version of that environment and those characters, and also figuring out that there were lots of ways in which the universe of Sandman and Lock and Key could took each other's hand into that comic. So it became so incredibly fun just to daydream about that it was a sort of creative exercise that we continued a long while of time. And the thing is, I think we arrived at the point in which we wanted to tell this story just a couple years ago, in which we got the blessing from DC Comics and Neil Gaiman to be able to do so. And it was equally incredibly for both Joe and myself. We started with this idea just because we looked up at Sandman and its mythology as one of the main references that gave birth to the seminal ideas of Lock and Key. So having the chance to get back to that as a way to pay tribute to that, but also to play with that toy box is amazing.
Well, and that's one of the things I think is so exciting. A lot of crossover like this, it feels like it's like, oh, the Transformers met the Ghostbusters, and then they never talked about it again. but it feels like with this book, it's like you're really marrying these two worlds together in a way that is like, it feels so nice. It feels like natural, but also just so exciting to combine it in this way.
I think for me to add to that, the one thing I always found exciting was crossovers back in the day used to be something big and important and noteworthy. And it was sort of like both companies brought their A-list talent to it. And then along the way, as more and more started happening, you know, the talent on the main book is busy. And so the sort of a secondary talent does the crossover. In this case, having Joe and Gabe do the crossover, I think just gives it that much more sort of gravitas and importance and really just cements it as part of this universe.
And the other thing is that's very important is that the idea for the crossover came from an idea for an actual story. We wanted to tell a certain story in this context. So it's not the thing that we thought that it could be fun to mash the universe of Sandman and Lock and Key because they sort of are similar. No, it was the idea of a story that we wanted to tell, the one that gave birth to the entire concept for the crossover. And I think that was more important for us. Most of crossovers tend to be like status quo event, status quo again. And we didn't want to do that. We wanted to do something in which we took like meaningful things, both those universes, make them collide and have an impact on both of them. So that's where it came from.
I wanted to do something that would rise to the level of my favorite crossover books, like when Superman fought Muhammad Ali, which I always thought was really touching because they get the ring together and then Superman throws a light jab and Muhammad Ali's head explodes. And then he goes full Zack Snyder and just laser visions Ali right in half.
Yeah.
It's a pretty hardcore,
but in slow-mo.
Page four, he's just holding intestines in his hands, you know, like with his eyes glowing red. And then the other 24 pages of the book were just, there was nothing on them. They were just completely blank. And like I thought that was a screwed up crossover, but it touched me as a kid. And,
we could tell. Yeah.
You right. haven't got the right edition of that
crossover.
The comics
authority were not paying attention when they submitted that one.
Yeah.
And similarly... I don't want to do any spoilers for this book, but the first book is they say, hey, can we get the key to hell? And they say, no, and then that's it.
Yeah.
But along those lines of like a crazy raised bar, like Lock and Key was so unbelievable. And I stalk Gabriel Rodriguez's Twitter for art because his art's fantastic. The fact that you guys pulled this off, and it's so magical and takes you to like this universe that you're like already like, okay, how are they going to do anything close to Lock and Key and how amazing that is. The fact that a super fan can then be blown away by this is really
That's
impressive.
Very kind. That's very kind.
I opened it up. I mean, do you start to see things in Gabriel Rodriguez's art at this point? Because like the just some of the pages, I was like, oh man, I can't even comprehend this. I just kind of lost a little bit.
Tripping balls right now.
But just today, I mean, just today, I was looking through the issue and I saw something I hadn't seen before. The panels are so intricate. There's we visit the Library of Dreams at one point in the first issue. I don't think that's a huge spoiler. We pay a visit there, and I just discovered these little guys hanging upside down under the staircase. You know, these little sort of Nemo and Slumberland figures staring out at us. And I'm like, I've looked at these pages 100 times now, and I'm still discovering new things. I thought for a long time, you know, it's been my great good fortune, you know, to be working front with Gabe, you know, side by side since the beginning, really. And you know, you think, you know, this is the best comics can get. This is so great. And then he raises the bar even higher.
I mean, the amount of great detail lost under all those word balloons is just
tragedy. It's a real tragedy.
Well, Gabriel, I do want to know, when you're tackling something like this, obviously Lock and Key is so intricate. We've talked to you incessantly about how much we love the art there. But when you're also tackling these Sandman worlds, when you're trying to draw them and meld them together, is there a different level of pressure there? I mean, how does it hit in terms of we're doing our own work versus we're tackling somebody else's work?
Yeah, well, there is. It's the point in which you need to be irresponsible enough to dive into something like this and not caring too much about it, because it's like doing brain surgery. Once you're at it, you just can't miss any movement.
And you're a brain surgeon as well, right? You're just like constantly...
I wish I would be.
I don't think you'd love his way of opening heads.
But the trick is... I think as long as the story is the driving force behind it, I feel like in a safe haven to try to do this. In a way, I've told a couple of people that I think I've done enough work in comics before this particular book to have enough tools to finally tackle something like this, feeling confident to be able to give the story what it needs. I still get upset with some drawings here and there, but I realize that I have as many tools as I need to tell something as complex as this, and also as dense as it is, because even though Joe might comment about the amount of detail that's in every panel, I'm amazed by the amount of mythology and story that we managed to cram in such few pages, because even though when we started discussing the ideas for this story, it was meant to be in Pale Battalions Go, it was going to be a single 20 pages issue, and then Hell and Gone was going to be two 20 pages issues, and that would be it, the way in which we were going to close the Golden Age arc.
I feel like you're looking at Joe.
And it ended up being almost 140 pages of comics, because in Pale Battalions ended up at 60 pages, and Hell and Gone is going to be 80. It's basically, we found a way to trick the publishers in doing a 4-issue miniseries in only 2 issues for our own sake as creators. But the thing is that I'm very impressed that when Joe started telling me the amount of ideas that he had for this story and all the characters that he wanted to play with and all the scenes that we were trying to get into it, I started thinking immediately, there's no way this is going to fit, not even in 80 pages. And then you had the script, and the amazing thing is not only that he managed to fit all that in, but also made it feel incredibly easy as a story as it could be. It feels incredibly welcoming for the reader, and either for a guy that actually knows everything behind the universes of Lock and Key and Sandman, or as a newcomer reader. So I'm very impressed by how polished the writing has become throughout the years in order to be able for someone to get to achieve something like this. And I think, in a way, one of the things that has been one of the strengths of the entire Lock and Key creative process, and now in this crossover, is the fact that we've been working together for over a decade or much more than that. So we know each other, we understand the stories in same way, we understand the way in which we want to tell the stories in the same way, and I think it all fits the creative process. I can't think of things that could come out more seamlessly than the work on books like this. So that's one of the things that make it incredibly fun.
Gabe does get really upset when he has to draw something on the page and he feels like, oh, I don't like that. That's just unpleasant looking. It's ruining my page, and you know, and I have to see something really, you know. So, but then you get the page over with and goes on.
Oh my God!
Really had to hold his nose and draw that. Alex cries just off the camera.
Oh my God!
No, Joe is just jealous because Alex Camillo in Lock and Key has more lines that he's owned. So,
slam, actor slam. And now in the main Lock and Key series, we get into some darkness. There's a lot of horror, and the series that followed in Pale Battalions, you hit true absolute sadness, despair. what's your next emotional gear? How far down the hole are you going to go here?
How you go, Joe? How do you think we're going to treat these guys?
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, as Joe said, we want to do stories as meaningful as possible with characters that we try to make the reader love as much as we may. We end loving them when we work with them. And one of the things that, for example, one of the things that surprised us the most when we were working in the Golden Age stories is how we got in love with the family of Chamberlain Locke through the course of very few pages. We started with these very short stories at the beginning, and we started like understanding this family, giving it a dynamic that's completely different from the one of the Locke family of the main story of the first six volumes. And we found things to fall in love with these kids that appeared just in brief episodes. So when you get the chance to do something like in Pale Battalion Go, in which you actually get Jack Locke to go to hell, actually, in that first story. You don't need to get to hell to be in hell as he was. I was obsessed with the idea of doing a war story that reflects how horrible war is in a way. It's the worst possible horror story that you can tell. And I think Joe delivered a magnificent script to do that. And then we ended up in Hell and Gone, falling into the arms of Mary Locke to carry us through this story, which has become a very fascinating character for us, because she started like a very side character in the family dynamics of Chamberlain. And suddenly she jumped up in the front, and we're absolutely dazzled by how much we think we can do with a character like her.
Yeah. Right.
She didn't even have a line the first comic we ever saw her. She was in Open the Moon, which was the first Chamberlain Locke story, you know, and she's just one of the other kids. There was a moment in Small World where you know, the house is a mess, and Chamberlain Locke, who is a, you know, man of the 19th century, you know, old-fashioned sort of almost Victorian patriarch, shouts that he's going to teach his daughters how to use a mop. And a few pages later in the story, Mary is fighting a giant spider, and she grabs the mop and splits it over her knee and then uses it as a spear. And you know, and I thought, huh, she's got something going on.
I like her style.
Yeah, I like her style. Yeah. When we started working on Hell and Gone, originally the conception would be that Chamberlain was the hero. And I actually wrote several pages where Chamberlain was going to be the lead character, but they didn't fly. It didn't ring true. And when the story sprang to life, it was when I decided that actually it was going to be, you know, that Mary was sort of going to pick up the baton. And then there was a moment Gabe drew the cover for the second issue, which I don't know if that's been shared publicly. Has it been?
No.
Chris, it hasn't been out yet? So he drew the cover for the second issue, and I was looking at Mary on it, and I thought, oh my God, did we make a superhero? I think maybe Gabe and I created a superhero when we weren't paying attention.
Cool.
That's exciting.
Yeah, she's pretty amazing in the book, and I don't want to get too much or at all into spoilers, since I know a lot isn't out
there. She's so much fun to write.
Well, she's got great. Some mischief. She's got a lot of the Locke family, and I won't say much about this, but like there's an innocent core. And she's got a little more mischief in there, I feel like.
She's, you know, absolutely. When I think about what she would do, I think, would Lauren Bacall do it in a movie with Humphrey Bogart?
Okay.
And if that feels right, then that's something Mary would probably do.
Yeah. Now, Joe, for you, on the Sandman side of things, this is, again, skirting spoilers, but it's set in a very specific period of time in the Sandman books that I think people will immediately recognize. How do you decide what part of that mythos to pick and choose and bring in there? Because it almost feels like there's a temptation to be like, oh, and then this character can come in, and then this character can come in. But certainly it holds back a little bit.
Well, let's see if you still think it holds back by the time we get to the second. we really took all the toys in the sandbox and made use of them. You know, I hate to sound like, you know, all sort of mystical, you know, new agey and spacey about it.
Okay.
But I don't really feel like I ever.
Which we know you are.
I don't really feel like I chose, like, you know, oh, let's set it in this era. It just, you know, it just happened that way. I mean, when we did start to, consider the possibility of seriously doing the crossover, I knew it would be about Chamberlain Locke's family, in part because the modern day family has already told their story. But also, I knew that in the early part of the 20th century, when Morpheus had been captured by Roger Burgess, that all of the characters, that whole immense cast of characters that we love from Sandman, was in play, and their stories had not been completely told. So if there was one place to jump in and add something, it was there. And things would be a little bit harder in the modern day, which presumably takes place after all the events of you know, Neil's original Sandman run.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, going over to the art, Gabe, for you, this is something that we were talking about before we came on, I guess was kind of a secret for a while, but came out on the trailer. So if you are listening or watching and don't want to know, a pretty big spoiler, it's out there. So I'm going to mention it, but earmuffs for a little bit. But Morpheus shows up here, which blew my mind. But what I also really liked about it is how you captured the art style there, how you drew Morpheus in a very specific way that felt very specific to Sandman. What was it like trying to tackle that?
It was the first idea that came into mind when I read the actual scene. In a way, I wanted to reflect the different nature of the characters in a way in which immediately pops up to the eye when you were reading the page. And I think it came out very naturally. It was an illustration I worked for several days because I wanted to get the right pose, the right framing, and then I did all the handmade artwork and then post-produced a bit. This is the very first couple pages of interior art of Lock and Key, which I actually colored part of it because I did the color of the main figure and then put it in a separated layer so J Photos could complete the coloring of the background around it. So
cool.
It was our first collaboration as colorists. And one of the things that emboldened me to try that was I knew how good Jay is handling the color. So despite trying something different with the art approach in this one, it wouldn't be a problem. I knew it wouldn't be a problem for him to find a way to get it into the context of the story. But the point was to try to make that character appear in a way that make him immediately a being of a different nature in the eyes of the reader once they get to that point of the story.
Hey, so when you, funny, I never even asked you this privately, but so if I can ask Gabe a question publicly, please. When you were working on your Morpheus, you know, there's a Sam Keith version, there's Kelly Jones, there's Mark Hempel, there's Craig Russell, there's all these Jill Thompson, all these amazing versions of Morpheus. Who, like, what was your key source material before you sort of made him your own? Like, whose version did you refer to, do you think?
It's hard to tell because I think it's all of them. In a way, I was a huge fan of the Sandman original run. I followed the entire series from issue 7 on, the one in which Death appears. That was the first one that got published in Spanish. We the edition from Spain here in Chile that we followed the entire run. It came with a little introduction of Prelude and Nocturnes added to that same issue. And from then on, I collected all the single issues to complete the entire series.
Gabe asked me in an email what version of Morpheus's helm was he doing. And he listed three different artists. And I said, I answered Gabriel Rodriguez's version.
Yes. and he was like, right answer, Joe.
I'll tell you something else. Gabe did something with the helm that no other artist has ever done. And it's so natural. And it looks so great. There's an interesting...
And it's very curious because... I thought I saw that somewhere, but then the editor from DC,
Chris Conroy,
an email saying
Chris Conroy had to
this
check
has never been done with the helmet before. I'm not sure if we can use it because we need to ask Neil and everything.
So the helm, the front of the helm, opens upwards in Gabe's vision. Yeah. So you have, so it encloses the whole head, but the front of the face separates and can be lifted.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
To reveal the face within. And you know, it's like, just because we've never seen that in any of the comics doesn't mean it couldn't always do it.
100%.
Yeah, I love that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And as it's all a dream, I've always thought that in a way that the visual approach to the Sandman series was this idea that every artist that drew the books gave their own vision of the dream in a different way. So I felt maybe a little, I don't know, I was like pushing the boundaries of this a little bit, trying to play with that idea. If it's something that could happen in a dream, which is basically anything, whatever you need in order to tell the story in the best possible way, I thought would be the right choice. One of the reasons I did the thing with the helmet in the story was because I wanted to make sure that even in the sequences in which the character had the helmet on, we would have the chance to see his or her actual face. Yeah. During certain action, and also have her hands free to do other stuff.
Yes.
Because it's very not functional. Exactly a helmet that you can put off and in your pocket. So,
can I just geek out for a second?
Sort of
about,
a natural solution for the storytelling needs.
Can I just geek out for a second about how great Gabe's House of Mystery is as well? I knew we had to get to the House of Mystery. I knew we had to spend time with Cain and Abel. And when our heroine arrives at the House of Mystery and we enter, it is the House of Mystery we know from all the other comics, and yet it isn't. And the idea that the House of Mystery is a shifting place because it lives on the edge of dream, and that its interior architecture is largely formed in reaction to the people visiting it, is an idea that I particularly like. And I just loved Gabe's wild vision of
the Cain and Abel scene is mind blowing among other parts. Like it's an amazing scene.
And Cain's reaction to that, the revelation that you just described about the house changing, he's like, I don't give a fuck. I don't know what you're talking about. Let's just keep going here. It feels so fun. So fun. So, Chris, let me ask you, what's the next trick you guys are going to do? Like lock and key and Amazing Fantasy 15? Or like where's the next move here?
I mean, it's got to be something meta like Deadpool, right? Who's used to going back into other lives. I figure that's a totally natural kind of crossover. I mean, that is the great thing about this is that Joe's been very sort of particular / precious / smart about not letting lock and key get used in the ways that that's another big.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was talk of other crossovers following this one that could have made sense from one point of view, but they don't really make sense in the lock and key world. So I'm glad that we're not just chasing, you know, bigger and bigger crossovers and kind of making sure that they matter.
I mean, this sort of goes back to where we came in, right? Because, like, you know, you asked when did we start, you know, thinking we wanted to bring our universe in, you know, and collide with Neil's. You know, and the thing is we figured out how to tell the lock and key stories because we're Sandman geeks. You know, it was reading the Vertigo comics of the 1990s fundamentally shaped our ideas. And I think I speak for all of us, for Gabe, for Chris, for Jay.
Absolutely.
You know,
for us.
That gave us a sort of landmark. And we're like, we want to go for that. And in some ways, writing the crossover was really, really difficult. Like trying to play six chess games at once or solve six, you know, Sunday New York Times crossword puzzles on the same day. But in other ways, it was very easy because the two, you know, thematically, emotionally, aesthetically, you know, fit together like hand and glove. You know, there's a kind of feel like they've been waiting for each other.
What's amazing about it is, you know, when Sandman was winding down, it was one of those that you knew it was something special, that it was this landmark series. And so for me, every issue was a thing that I just savored because I knew once it was gone, there wasn't going to be another. And when we were working on Lock and Key, building toward Alpha and Omega, it was that same sense. I'd get a script in and go, like, really try to savor it, thinking it's all coming to an end. So, like, that we're now in sort of this overtime period where we're able to kind of give me and everybody else back that same feeling that those series used to evoke is really exciting.
And let me just say that it feels like those moments when you're a kid and you're like, oh, I want to stay up a little later. And you talk to your parents and they're like, yeah, you can stay up for another half an hour. And you're like, oh my God, I can stay up for another half an hour. That's what every book feels like. So please keep us up. Keep us up nights.
Now, we do have a bunch of questions from folks over in the YouTube comments and also here on Crowdcast, so I do want to get at least to a couple of them. This is from Adrian Streether on YouTube. Joe,
Adrian's a huge Lock and Key guy. We love Adrian.
Oh, there you go.
All right.
What is the next crossover universe that could happen or that you would like to happen? Nosferatu, maybe?
You know, there is a key to the Candy Cane Gates. There is a key to Christmas Land. I would never do a crossover just to do a crossover. You know, it was tremendous to be able that Neil invited us in and let us have fun in his universe. But there is an arc there to the begin. There is a set of stories about Chamberlain Locke, Fiona Locke and their children that begins with chronologically. It begins with Small World and continues through a whole series of stories, through Open the Moon, through a story people haven't seen called Face the Music. Can we talk about the comic and the soundtrack album? Are we not allowed to talk about? There's no sound. Should I just not have said that?
No. Yeah, we shouldn't have. We shouldn't elaborate on that.
No, okay, never mind.
It feels like you should though.
No, never mind. I'm sorry. I don't know what I said. There's
a glitch.
Small World and Open the Moon and Face the Music and then Pale Battalions. And then the finale. But that is, you know, there is a story that is being told there about the optimism of the young and, you know, the forward looking at the beginning of the 20th century and then the reality of the 20th century, you know, the punishing reality of the 20th century and what it did to, you know, in that First World War and, you know, and that's been really satisfying to explore. And Sandman, the leap into the Sandman universe was an organic way to continue that. And I don't think we would have wanted to do it just to do it.
Yeah. It has to be a story that drives the creative idea. Otherwise, it would be like a forced exercise that probably would be exhausting and not make a point. One of the things that, as Joe said, was doing this crossover was both easy and hard because it was easy the way in which the story naturally drove us to do this. But the hard part was how to measure our own ambition and how to tackle this, how to be sure what was the stuff that was worthy to put on the page and the one that we need to hold back. In a way, for example, trying to, I don't know, to pick certain character and get him or her a bigger role that the story needed just for the sake of playing with that character. But being able to restrain for that was like the hardest part to do on this. So I really hope that what you finally see in each of the pages of the story is what the story needed to be and what's going to be the most rewarding reading experience.
I mean, I think sometimes we can boil it all down to saying Hellboy. The answer to the question is Hellboy.
I mean, just and then I'll move on to another question to get super nerdy about it, though, Joe. The Key House is an Inkscape in Nosferatu, and since Key House and Sandman all exist in the same universe, technically they all exist in the same universe, so it's not too much of a lift, right?
That's an interesting thought. I'm not actually sure. I know about the map in Nosferatu. I know that the map refers to the Lovecraft Keyhole, which is a reference to Key House. But I'm not sure that Key House is an Inkscape.
Okay.
You know, so that does actually seem a little bit like a flaw in Charlie Manx's map of the United Inkscapes of America, but let's just glide over that.
Not his biggest problem.
Yeah.
He has some other issues.
One of the things that's fun about the way in which Joel writes fiction, I think, is the fact that he's constantly showing you doors and locks and keys and not necessarily explains you how they work or what's their purpose, but they are there. And when you need to get through certain door or need to pick certain key or need to open certain lock, it's there to play with them. So I think in a way, it's a creative process of planting seeds here and there and waiting for the right time of each of us to blossom properly. So,
well, I have to say that we have actually, we hung a lantern for something in Pale Battalions. We hung a lantern for something that won't come to pass until book 5 of World War Key, which is still a hypothetical series. I mean, which would not come out before, which, you know, at the rate we're going, would probably not come out.
It's like 400 pages away.
You know, there is. So, and I'll actually, okay, so here's something I can spoil. This bad guy, Eric Murnau, who is a German officer in World War I, enters Key House and discovers about the power of the keys. And then, you know, big spoiler, you might want to cover your ears if you haven't read Pale Battalions yet. In the final issue of Pale Battalions, he's knocked out. He's dragged back to Germany. He had, if you look in the panels ahead of that, he had discovered there was a teddy bear key that operates one of the teddy bears. He still has that key in his hand when he's dragged back to Germany.
Ooh.
Which matters, but won't matter until book 5 of World War Key, which would be the book about World War II.
Mm. Wow. So very interesting.
It won't matter in the story until 20 years after those events, which is probably
I hope
20 years after we have this conversation.
I hope we can still remember it. I mean, like, that's the thing to worry about.
Just,
like, you know,
listen to this podcast.
That's the same thing.
Every week.
Yeah.
Gabe, this is a question
I'm
for
sure
you.
I'm sure Pete is going to remind us.
Yes, exactly.
I'm on it. I'll set a reminder. I'll set a Google invite. Okay. Life of Lauren says, question for Gabe, where do you get into your inspiration for your art style? Thanks.
I never thought of myself as a guy that's pursuing an art style. I think I just came out with what's coming out in the pages just by the process of drawing over and over and I try to portray the characters in the best possible way and the scenarios in the most fulfilling way and just with the tools that I have. I'm an insane nerd studying lots and lots of artists. I have a folder with over, I don't know, 200 different artists and art samples that I'm constantly studying, trying to figure out how people use different art supplies and they depict certain gestures and body language and how the guys that draw with only single lines compared with guys that uses these masses of ink to try to convey certain effects. And all of that, I try to mash them up in my brain and trying just to figure out how I envision things in terms of putting it on the page to tell the story. I think in a way my art style is just the result of that process, and I'm just trying to get better. The thing that drives me the most is try to portray the characters in the best possible way, to make them feel real. For me, the ultimate goal is to make the reader forget that they're watching drawings, that they're watching just dots and lines and spots of ink on a page. And I think that's what the thing that fascinates me the most about making comics. The thing that you can just take a few abstract shapes and combine them in certain way and make people think that's a living character that you can care for and relate to.
And make people cry.
Actual casting of magic for me.
Make grown people cry is what I get.
Yeah.
Let me also say, Gabe, when we first met you, we had at San Diego Comic-Con like 10 years ago. We said, that guy's an insane nerd, just like you. Yeah.
But you are the master of that. Like, we talked about how, like, you when we opened up your book, like, we jumped. We were scared. Like, we were there in it. It wasn't like a comic that I was safely not a part of. You do the thing that draws people in, but there's a realism, and it's so very moving.
Gabe pulled off the first jump scare in the history of comics.
Yeah. It was just having a character named Dr. Zalbin just scared the shit out of me.
I still get scared every time I look in the mirror. Every morning.
In the first book, there's a moment when Bodhi is in the well house sitting on the windowsill, and he turns around to shout to Kinsey. And it takes you a second for your eyes to focus on the woman coming out of the well behind him.
Yeah.
And I know readers have talked about that, working as a jump scare. I had heard that you couldn't do jump scares in comics, that that just was physically impossible. But
it's hard. Pages aren't moving.
Done, yeah, I guess I realized.
On several occasions.
Yes, yeah. Agreed.
Joe, this is
the
a question for you.
The only possible I haven't been able to do is meet my deadlines, but besides that.
Joe, this is for you from Enrique Chumbes. Any more plans to expand your imprint Hill House?
Ed, no comment.
All right. M Spear 632 says, also for Joe, I've heard you say you don't outline your comics. What's the secret to them tying together so many pieces of your stories? I think we kind of touched on this a little bit earlier.
Chris, do you have an answer for that? Because I don't.
I would say the rewrites. I mean, every time I get a script for you, it's revision 6 or 7, and most scripts I get are people's first drafts, or maybe they've gone through it once. But I mean, you're working these things over and over again before you're even ready to show anybody.
One thing is usually I've got a couple scripts before Gabe starts drawing. You know, this is going back to back in the day when we were doing the original Lock and Key run. Typically with any of those 6-issue runs, I would have the first 2 issues written before I felt comfortable, you know, pulling the trigger and saying, okay, you can go ahead and start drawing, you know, go for it. And so I would get a couple issues, and then generally I could write quickly enough so that I could get to like issue 5 when Gabe was starting to draw issue 2. And then I could start to see what I would need to make the ending work, and could usually go back and fix shit in issue 3, right. So that it all looked like I had it all planned all along.
No, but the thing is, watching from the outside and seeing Joel's creative process throughout something as long as has been like writing Lock and Key, what I think it's one of, I think he has like 2 very important qualities as a writer. One is that he always aims to an ending. Joe is really good at not dragging stories. He really aims every effort, every piece he places in the storytelling aims to something that's going to drive to a meaningful ending. And that's something that's both very hard to do, but he sort of had an instinct for that and demands a lot of effort. I think most of his rewrites are about cleaning the stuff that is sort of
extraneous.
Cleaning out of the forest of the branches that confuse the path. And the other thing is something that I somewhat thinks that applies to the entire creative process of Lock and Key, in which I think both of us are very pay a lot of attention to detail, because it's, as I say when I talk about the artwork that I try to do, it's not about the amount of detail, but putting the details that you actually need for the story that you're telling. And Joe is incredibly good at that. He can, sometimes he has these very complex ideas that he discussed over and over throughout the process. And then he sets a scene in which 2 characters just having a conversation of 3-word balloons tackle that. And that's incredible, because it the main difficulty of comics is being able to put as much as possible in as few space as you can. It's basically about compressing stuff, but doing it in a meaningful way. And that's something that he's a natural at it.
That's great.
I don't know if this is scratching up on the thing we're not supposed to talk about, but JC Barrow SF says, any suggested soundtrack for the crossover?
I would say download Torin Borrowdale's terrific music for the Lock and Key TV show. Which is available on iTunes, you know, and
on Spotify.
On Spotify, right, you know, and I don't know if it's ever going to have a physical release, but we can all hope, right? Wouldn't that be great?
I was going to say it needs to be a playlist of Nickelback and Tori Amos. I mean, obviously.
That's all I listen to 24/7.
Basically.
I can pitch my playlist. I've got a Hill House Radio playlist on Apple. Which is like the music I'm listening to right now. So if anyone wants to know what I'm listening to right now.
There really should be a trigger warning for the Ed Sheeran song that's on that playlist. But
Wow, blown up right
Let
there.
The man do his karaoke while he writes.
Chris, you're just lightly singing the whole time you're writing.
Chris, this is going to be great for the audio podcast, but there's a couple of people in the YouTube comments that want to know what the rest of your shirt looks like. They're very interested in your Lucha Libre shirt.
It's a taco joint in San Diego. It's their tacos are better than their shirts, and their shirts are pretty great. But if I'm doing commercials, could I do another quick one?
Absolutely.
This key that we were showing off is one of Skeleton Crew's latest productions. They've been making replica keys for the series for the last 5-6 years. This is the biggest, heaviest, most lethal one that they made, and they're going to start taking pre-orders tomorrow.
Really?
That's going to be allowed to be mailed.
It weighs a pound.
It looks amazing. Terrifying. Terrifying key.
And it's the size to scale of the key in the Kelly Jones Season of Mists.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
That is very, very cool. Now, we could talk to you, I think, about this all night, and I definitely would want to, but we got to let you go at some point. But before I do, I wanted to ask about anything you could say about the TV show, because as we mentioned, we've been loving the TV show as well. Yeah. I know they're in production on season 2. It sounds like they're starting to wrap things up. Season 3 has already been greenlit, which is awesome. Yeah. Other than that, anything you can tell us?
Well, I think one of the things that we can mention is that's going to be several new keys coming in the new seasons that I think is going to be a lot of fun. In a way, as Netflix has trusted in the hands of Mary Thurible, Carlton Cuse, and all the creative team behind the Lock and Key series, they are so confident of what they're doing that they really allow them to open the floodgates for the next couple seasons, and it's going to a really all-in game. It's I think Season 1 is going to be like the tip of the iceberg of what you're going to see in terms of drama, magic, horror, mystery in the next seasons.
Timing of it all is Netflix's announcement to make, but just detail-wise, like, we're real happy with where it's all headed.
I feel like the first season was like those first MCU films, you know, like Captain America and Iron Man, and that the second season is like Avengers.
Wow.
It's on such an epic scale, and it just completely goes for
it. I just wanted to get here so these guys can get their recaps going again. I enjoyed those.
Can't wait. Truly, yeah. Like, us talking about those episodes is so fun. And the way the first season ended was just like a real double punch. You expect one punch, but that second punch.
What's really great is they've decided to do a crossover in the TV series as well. We couldn't make it work with Lock and Key Sandman, but Floor is Lava is going to be in their Key House edition, and that should be awesome.
Yeah, wow. Well, the story of Floor Lava is so good.
Yeah, you guys are talking about how you only do crossovers that matter, so it makes sense that Floor is Lava.
And I've heard that there are millions of signed online letters and polls demanding for a Paramedics spin-off of the Lock and Key series that they're sort of studying. Because
you better.
I know the crowds are asking.
Matheson
for
Paramedics. Matheson 911.
Matheson 666.
I would tune in. I would tune in for it.
Before we let you go, just got a review. You got the Hell Key. The Key to Hell is coming out from Skeleton Crew tomorrow. Also, obviously, the first issue of Lock and Key, Sandman, Helen Scone. The second issue...
No, it's not Helen Scone.
Helen Scone. It's not Helen Scone. I can't pronounce it.
That's going to be the next series.
Yeah.
And then the second issue, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's Sandman Universe, Lock and Key, Sandman... Hell and God, number 2.
Yeah, the way this crossovers with DC work is it alternates publishers. So DC will be putting out the second chapter, which will be 48 pages.
Ooh, wow.
And it'll
confusingly also numbered 1.
Oh, good.
I guess it's because it's like the first issue is like Lock and Key, Sandman Universe, number 1. And then the second one is like Sandman Universe and Lock and Key, number 1. So I'd be too weirded out.
I think we'll figure it out.
Yeah, we got
I can confirm that a lot of pages in there.
Yeah. Everyone knows number one issues
really
sell the
hard
best.
To draw.
Everyone knows number one issues sell the best. And from here on out, I think all series should just go to number one format.
World War Key is just a series.
Just be number one.
Yes.
It's going to be so hard to get to World War Key number 5 if every issue is number 1. I'll tell you that.
Guys, thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations on the book. It is absolutely fantastic. I can't wait for people to check it out.
Thank you for the book.
So good seeing you guys.
It's amazing. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for your enthusiasm, Guy.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure to talk.
Pleasure. All right. Take care.
Here we go.
Later, guys.
All right. There we go.
Oh, man.
There we go. Once again, Joe Hill, Gabriel Rodriguez, and Chris Ryall for Lock and Key, Sandman, Hell and Gone. Number one, which is out from IDW and also DC tomorrow. Definitely pick it up. Again, we're not going to give out spoilers here, but it's awesome.
It's so good.
Bananas.
Yes.
Like, it is so, like, I knew it was going to be great. And I was surprised with how great it was.
It's so unbelievable. Good. Now, guys, we have plenty more show to go past this, so we're going to keep going with my favorite section, other than the interview, I guess, which was pretty good.
Yeah, Alex, why are you downplaying the interview?
You're downplaying
the interview, Alex.
But here we go with some audience questions.
All right.
And for the audience questions, it's pretty straightforward. You can drop questions in the YouTube comments about absolutely anything nerdy or geeky. Also, an ask a question here on Crowdcast, but we're going to kick it off, like we always do, with what you drinking. Pete, what you drinking? Pete?
Oh, he's nope, drinking he's his got own internet. I'm drinking a little Two-Hearted. Nice. You know, after a nice long day at work, you really want to go with both hearts. Two-Hearted Ale from Bell's.
I also like drinking beer with fish on it, so I'm drinking a Ballast Point Sculpin.
Ooh, yes, good
stuff. I found it at the store, and I was very excited.
You found it at the store.
What a delightful treat for me.
Drinking a fish.
Oh, man. Fish beers. Good time.
Land shark.
Where, are you in the Florida Keys? Are you on spring break right now? You're at Senior Frogs? No. What's happening with you?
Now, we got a couple of questions about Lock and Key, which I'm sorry to anybody we didn't get to, but why don't we start off with this one? Edward Doherty says, what are the best subtle comic costume redesigns? I'm thinking about the silvery texture added to the Flash's costume when Wally took over from Barry, or changing the blue tone of Batman's cape and cowl.
These are good.
The armpit webbing.
That's a good one.
Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or on you.
On me. When that finally came in. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was creeped out about it as a teenager, so I'd pick it off and flush it. Oh. My armpit webbing.
Alex.
Oh, my God. What just happened?
Tell you what, that's a fine. You can say that whatever you want, but when you said flush it, that's when I was not happy.
I was grossed out by Pickett. Once he said Pickett, I was out. I was done.
Oh, I've liked a lot of the Aquaman redesigns over the years. I feel like, and those aren't super subtle, but that book sort of across the board.
He had no arm.
He lost a hand. The ultimate redesign is giving up a hand.
Similarly, when they redesigned Speedball and then he became Penance, that was pretty subtle.
Very subtle.
Yes.
Hardly noticed. Still just as fun.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, it's hard to say just because I feel like every artist and colorist kind of has their own take on stuff. So thinking about Spider-Man, there's been so many different hues for his costume over the years. Yeah. It's difficult to point to one in particular.
I've got a good one. It is a cop-out, but I'll give you a good one. Iron Man. The armor redesigns have been... I love when we get to see him sort of retroactively, like when he had the triangle light laser in front there. I thought it was like, why would he make it a triangle? Doesn't make any sense except for the drawing part.
I'll give you a very dumb one, which isn't necessarily a costume redesign, but Bullseye after the Daredevil movie, when he had the bullseye in his head.
Yeah.
That's cool. That was like a subtle little thing, but it's very cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. I'm thinking of doing that.
Should we do that live on the show? What do you think?
Yeah, I can help you with that.
That'd be a fun live event.
I would love to brand you right in the middle of your forehead.
I don't want to brand. God,
this is getting very dark.
He was saying it's a permanent line. It's like, that wasn't just like lines because he took a nap on his forehead. Like, that was real.
No, I think he slept face down on a Target bag. And that's why he had that.
Eduardo says, is that a robot on Justin's shirt? Is it from a comic?
Yes, of course it is. It is our pal Weapon X, Weapon X.
Oh, yeah. So kind of a robot.
You know, he was more machine than man for a brief time.
Yes, he was.
This is the from Barry Windsor Smith's famous run in Marvel Comics Presents, which really opened a lot of doors for Wolverine's origin.
It's weird that that's part of his origin still, right?
I love that part.
Yeah.
That series is so good. It was like, and Barry Windsor Smith is an artist that I feel like really occupied a certain section of the comic book world and then didn't really continue after that. And it's great stuff.
Yeah.
Which one of you has the ice cream music playing in the background?
That's me. It's driving me crazy. It's parked outside because it knows that the second this show ends, I'm going to buy so much goddamn ice cream.
You should treat yourself.
Yeah, it's like that Simpsons thing with he's putting my kid through college.
Alex, it's nighttime. Why is your ice cream man stalking you?
I really don't know.
What's nighttime got to do with anything?
Alex, that might be the ice cream man from the comic book.
Oh,
that's
no.
Pretty messed up. I hope not. Now, I didn't ask this one because we kind of covered it in the interview, but I'm curious to get your guys' take on it. This is from First Hand Up Guy. What else could cross over with the Sandman or Lock and Key and still feel tonally consistent?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. I that's why I sort of asked that question. I feel like Lock and Key and Sandman is really a really nice marriage and connection.
Street Bullet says Ghostbusters. Which
Joel says Knight Rider.
I mean, both feature keys. Knight Rider, yeah. Car keys, yeah. Obviously. Mm-hmm. Ghostbusters, Keymaster, Gatekeeper. Well, I mean, makes a lot of sense.
The thing is, it's like Gabriel Rodriguez's art is magical. Like he can do anything. So I don't know. Like, but I do appreciate the fact of like, if it's got a crappy story, what are we here for? So I am impressed with their answers, even though they kind of stuck with it a couple of times. I think it's really impressive not to do something just to be like, wouldn't this be cool? You know,
we need to get the kit key that makes any car talk.
Oh man.
Just put it in and turn it on. The car's hello, Michael. I have a bunch of opinions now.
The car key.
That's a horrible kit impression.
Because we're talking about this and the music is driving me crazy. Almost too on the nose, but Ice Cream Man crossing over potentially would work just for like a one-shot horror.
Oh, that would be... Ooh, that would be a fun to see them play in that sandbox a little bit. Would be really cool.
This is from Nelson Martinez over on YouTube. Loving Invincible, the podcast so far. Who's your favorite voice actor on the show? What do you guys expect in the next episode? So we have been doing an Invincible podcast called Podvincible that everybody should check out.
That's the one name for it. That's the one name for it.
Are you saying I don't know if people should check it out, Pete?
I'm saying I don't know.
I work hard on this thing.
No, I don't know if that's going to be our final name. We still have the vote on it.
Okay. I hate to tell you about
Kirkmania. Come on, Kirkmania. Yeah.
Pete, why don't you start then? What is your favorite voice actor on the show, and what do you guys expect in the next episode?
I don't know. There are so many amazing voices on the show, and it's like every episode, it's like, wait, what? I mean, Mahershala Ali is, his voice alone is so magical. I don't know. There's just a lot of great talent on the show. I can't wait for Seth Rogen to come back, though. I loved his One-Eyed Alien. It was really just really fun.
Alan Alien. I want to give it up for Battle Beast, Michael Dorn, Worf from TNG. Great to hear him out.
Deep Space Nine. Don't erase that part of his history.
I'm not erasing if we're going to talk about where Worf's from, it's TNG.
All right, that's
no, who's like saying like, oh, Worf? Loved him on Deep Space Nine. Never watched anything else, any Worf-related material.
You know, I was thinking earlier today how much I like Sandra Oh on the show. And they've really beefed up the role of Debbie quite a bit from the comics very purposefully. But as opposed to everybody else who is so big and so bold and superheroes and supervillains, just having a regular person character in the middle there, it's kind of a thankless performance, but she's doing a great job with it.
Well, and I would throw out there that I think the way the series has positioned Debbie and Nolan are really like the two poles of Mark, and like a way that the comic series really didn't. It was much more about the drama of it. And this feels like it actually has like a thematic a real thematic purpose to it, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And what do you think is going to happen next? This is obviously potentially getting into spoilers, but we got 3 episodes left in the season. So what are you looking forward to seeing?
I mean,
the problem is we've read it. So yeah. It's like, I don't want to spoil anything or like, you know.
Yeah. Trouble. More blood on the title card is what I can predict.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to get bloodier.
We got another lock and key related question here from Edward Doherty. I have had more success recommending and having non-comics people actually finish Lock and Key than any other series. What do you attribute this to?
Such an easy rec. Because two magical people came together and made an unbelievable comic. And it's undeniable. You can't just say Lock and Key. It's just undeniable. So it's such an easy rec.
Yes, Pete is trying to be adopted by Joe and Gabriel. Godspeed. I think it's because the characters are so, like, they draw you in so hard. You feel so much alongside those characters from the beginning and throughout. Not just, I feel like a lot of comics that are like, oh, check this out, you might like this. It's not the story doesn't always draw you through the whole thing, through the characters. And the way that Lock and Key just is written, you're with them, each character individually, as well as the family together throughout the entire run.
I also think a lot, like Sandman is a lot of people's first rec in terms of comic books. It's accessible, which I know is a very broad way of saying it, but people know what horror movies are. You know what the characters are immediately. Like we were talking about, Gabriel's pacing is very cinematic in terms of the panels. So somebody whose only experience is with movies or TV shows, handing them something like that, I think it's a little easier to understand the visual language of Lock and Key. But the other thing that I don't think you should undervalue is that it's complete. Like, it's a complete story over several volumes. Obviously, it's expanding now, but it's the same thing with Sandman, where you can say, hey, it starts and then the story ends after a couple volumes and you're done. So I think it's versus saying, oh, man, you got to check out issue 1020 comics, which is a hard lift. This is something that is complete that you can hand to somebody.
I just also think that, like, the art tries to do different things. Like, it's not just, okay, this is what this comic is, and now I'm used to this. It pushes itself. Each different issue is trying different genres, and it's really impressive. And even Joe Hill was impressed with going back and not noticing things in the artwork. It's just so detailed. I can't say enough amazing things about it. And if I don't know what you're doing if you're not checking it out.
I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what you're doing.
I know. This is from Kevin. What are some comics that you think would fit well with a drink as a merchandising tie-in, alcoholic or non, and what would that drink be?
Ooh, interesting.
Ooh. Just any Wolverine issue with a can of beer duct taped to it?
Duct taped?
What are you talking about? Like Edward 40 Hands? What are you talking about?
Yeah, we talk
is
about
he on Krakoa, by the way. They haven't established that yet.
Edward 40 Hands?
Yes.
Yes, the famous
he keeps
X-Men.
Dying and they keep bringing him back.
Wolverine is like, it's like, oh, he's always in bars, but like, he's not someone who I'm like, that guy really drinks, or like, he's always like holding a beer, but it doesn't ever affect him. Like, I don't associate him with drinking quite as much.
Huh, interesting.
I think you're right. Similarly, and this is a very, very much off topic, but I don't know if you guys have been watching Superman and Lois, but there's at least once an episode, Lois and Clark kind of hang out on the porch and have a glass of wine. And Clark's like, ah, thank you. It's been a hard day. And I'm like, what is that doing for you? Is Superman, that's not affecting you in any way whatsoever.
Sometimes it's just a nice, you know, thing to do. But I would just say, like, don't worry too much about the comic. What do you like drinking? You know what I mean? Put yourself at ease, and then you'll be more open to the comic that you're into. You know, I appreciate what you're trying to do, but, like, treat yourself, too. You know what I mean?
What was that comic from a few months back? Maybe it was called Spy Island that we really liked. And a pina colada was the first thing that jumped into my head.
I was thinking of like
also Stray Bullet, our resident chef, suggests Lock and Key with an old school absinthe. Melt a sugar cube into your glass through a slotted spoon. That's a good choice as well.
Very nice.
We'll do one more question here. This is from Jay Sinison. Which currently living comedian has the best chance of surviving being a headliner of the Gotham City Comedy Festival?
Great question. Quick story while you guys are thinking of an answer. I came up from work the other night. I work here in the basement, and I came upstairs, and my wife is halfway through watching Joker, and she turns to me and goes, "This is the best movie I've seen in the last 10 years." I was like, what? This is insane for like 9 reasons.
Oh my God. First off,
do you know how much I've talked about this? I've talked about this movie for hours. And now you're watching it and you're like, I love this. The pandemic may have.
Wow. Now I'm worried.
Well, I'm so sorry you guys broke up.
Honestly, I would say, and I watched the second half of there and it was less of a, it was better than when I watched it before. I don't know if that's because the world is a little bit darker and crazier.
Yeah, the world is beating you down a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Or it was more like, wow, my wife has an interest in something that I like, or like it is in my world anyway.
Yeah. We can have something to talk about.
This is literally your Joker origin story.
Yeah. Exactly.
Stop.
Scary? That's scary when I make my mouth smile?
Yeah, stop. What was the question?
I don't know. which currently living comedian has the best chance of surviving being a headliner of the Gotham City Comedy Festival?
I don't know. Is that a shot at something? Like, I don't understand what the question is.
I think the idea is like a comedian that has to be so good or so bad they could sort of endure against the Joker.
Oh, okay. All right.
Man, I don't know. Who, Dave Chappelle?
Yeah.
Joker would be like, you're all right.
Yeah, he would be like, I'm not going to kill you. You're really good.
Yeah. I think Carrot Top. Because Joker would be like, yo, that guy's fucked up.
Yeah, he's a Batman villain.
That guy's weird.
All right. And folks, that is it for your audience questions. All right. We are going to move on to our next section, which is trivia. And for that, we're going to turn it over to Mr. Pete Le
Pay.
There it is. That's
the
how you
star it. Of the star of Le Trivia, Pete LePage.
All right. This is the part we give back to you, the lovely audience. It's an opportunity to win $25 free in the form of a gift card to Midtown Comics online. So you can go buy yourself some comics all safe and not have to, go out into that crazy world. All we would need is a first hand up so you can participate in tonight's trivia where you will win $25.
And if you're over on YouTube, if somebody hasn't already snagged it over at Crowdcast, just say me and we will figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll make it happen.
We'll make it happen.
The captain will make it happen.
Okay.
Captain Morgan Run, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks.
Great. Oh, Pete CBC says thanks. Should we bring him in for trivia?
Let's bring him in. I would want to talk to that guy. He's got a lot of strong opinions.
Mm-hmm. How are you guys doing?
Oh, wow.
Who knows?
Oh, we got a hand up from MSpear632 on YouTube. All right. Now, I'll mention there is a little bit of a delay with YouTube, so we're going to make this work the best we can. Pete's going to ask the question. You drop the answer in the YouTube chat, A, B, or C. You'll be able to figure it out, and it'll be good. And then you walk away with $25. So, Pete, take it away.
All right, here we go. Today's trivia is on topical comic news and a small nod to the legend DMX.
Mm,
here we go. Please listen to all three. It's YouTube, so okay. Here we go. Question number one. For Marvel's Star Wars War of the Bounty Hunter, what droid is going to get its own variant cover? Is it A, BB-8, B, IG-88, or is it C, Blair Underwood? So it's either A, don't pick it, or it's B.
We'll see what Mike, or M. Spear, I think it's Mike, answers. But what's your favorite Blair Underwood movie in the meantime?
Great question.
Thank you.
I guess that would be, I don't know any of those.
Oh, come on. Blair's done a ton of great stuff.
Okay, hit us. Name two. We obviously have one.
Says B. There we
go. Yeah, all right.
Let's move on to the next question.
Okay, here we go. BC dropped a trailer for what new animated movie? Is it A, The Long Halloween, B, Batman Needs a Therapist, or is it C, Angie Martinez? Is it A, and you will be correct, or you can pick B or C?
Nice. Well, we'll just wait for that to come through. And Pete, did you name another Blair Underwood movie outside of the one that you're going to sort of say in a second?
I do know his work. I'm blanking right now, but I am.
Oh, A? Is it A?
A is correct.
All right. Mike got it right. There we go. Sorry, ask the third question, Pete.
Here we go. Okay. So I was in the middle of responding to a stray bullet. Okay. Here we go. Last one.
A little trivia, Pete. You gotta concentrate.
Pete, how many many balls are you trying? How many plates are you trying to keep spinning?
Too much.
Pete, just focus on what's in front of you. For
last, okay.
You're the star of trivia. If you can handle the pressure, pass it off. I'll be the star. I will be the star.
You do enough.
It's my shot.
Here we go.
Let me be the star.
Marvel to launch three new X-Men titles. Which title will be one of the three? Is it A, Fuck Island 2, Too Fast, Two Islands, who give each other love and consent, but everyone else run for your fucking lives? B, Way Number of the one. X, or is it C, Wiz Khalifa? So it's either A or it's B, which is the correct answer.
Yeah, one of those B. is too long to be a title, for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes things are long.
Titles do
just real quick before Mike gives his final answer. What's that other Blair Underwood movie, Pete?
It just dropped it.
I know a bunch of his stuff.
Oh, A? Is it A? Oh, B. B.
B. B.
B.
B.
There we go. Mike, congratulations. You've won a $25 gift card to Midtown Comics. Shoot us an email at comicbookclublive@gmail.com and we will get that right off to you. Now, folks, as we all know, this is New Comic Book Week. Comics come out whenever. Most of them tomorrow, some of them today. That's all fine. But what are you guys looking forward to that's coming out at some random time?
Well, first, I just got to say the answer to the thing is The After Party, which is a great movie.
Great.
Similarly,
okay, I would
the After Party for trivia is where we talk about what we're looking forward to. Pete?
I would say Lock and Key, Hell and Gone,
like on Wheel of Fortune where they give you RSTLNNE. Like it's like we know that. You know?
Okay,
you know what I'm talking about wheelheads out there.
Sure. Also, Wonder Woman number 771.
Yeah, that's been real good. Justin, what about you?
I mean, a lot of good stuff, but let me just, this is some real, like, old-fashioned nostalgia shit to throw out. I'm going to give it up for the Darkhawk book, Heart of the Hawk, coming out tomorrow. Really does a good job, or will, I assume, do a good job of taking you back to that nostalgia, while also maybe setting up a story for the future.
Interesting. I am, well, not looking forward to because it's actually already out, but Rorschach number 7 from DC Comics, which has one of the wildest cameos I've ever seen in any comic ever. Very curious to talk to you guys about it. We are going to talk about that and much more on our Stack podcast, which is in the Comic Book Club feed and also its dedicated Stack feed, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. So, folks, definitely check that out there. And that is it for our show.
What an episode. What an episode.
First of all, thank you to our amazing guests, Joe Hill, Gabriel Rodriguez, and Chris Ryhall. Don't forget to check out Lock and Key, Sandman, Hell and God number 1.
You won't be sorry.
Tomorrow. And as mentioned, the key to hell is also going to be from Skeleton Crew. So definitely pick that up next week on the show. We're going to have another packed show. Elliot Rahl and Emily Pearson from The Vein, which we've been enjoying, are going to be here. Also, yes. Kurt Pyers, Guy Behind Youth is going to be here, which would be very cool. Sorry, that should be a super fun show. Check out Marvel Vision, our Marvel podcast. We're talking about Falcon the Winter Soldier every Friday. Podvincible, our Invincible podcast, is also out on, well,
Kurt Mania.
Sometimes. It comes out sometimes, but check that out on its feed. Patreon.com/comicbookclub to support our show. iTunes, Android, Spotify, Stitcher, or the app of your choice to subscribe, listen, and follow. At Comic Book Live on Twitter. ComicBookClubLive.com for this podcast and more. Until next time, good night!
Good night! We have a real open spot in May for more podcasts.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Aaron.